Hi, Anurag. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, did you always see yourself in like the business world, doing like tech stuff? Whatever you're doing today, like, I mean, I don't know. I think you travel also a bit. So, is this like what you had in mind? Like,
No. I don't think anyone sits in college and thinks I'll be a VC one day.
I think there are people who wouldn't be now.
Not when I was in college. I didn't know what VC was.
I think in the early 2000s at least, I think there was no, was there like a concept of like how, you know, Y Combinator and all that there?
First of all, let me clarify, I went to college in the late 2000s. So, there were some angels, there were some very small homegrown funds.
You're talking about late 2000s.
Okay. Right. So for to give you context, I think Nexus started in 2004. Most Axel Sequoia around that time. So
2004.
Yeah. But still like early days, right? These are all like very very early days of Indian VC. It's not, there weren't even startups that many to talk about. I think out of college for me, startups were interesting. I'm an engineer, so I liked writing code, and I thought if I'm writing code, I might as well do it at a startup than at a big company.
Mm-hmm.
I think I only had visibility around that. That I'd like to work with tech startups, and that's all I did. I wasn't really thinking of VC or anything. I genuinely enjoyed writing code. I still do. I write code every day, even today.
Really? Even today?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, when did you start programming?
When did I must have been, let me think, 15?
15, no? Like, did you have like a lot of tech exposure, like in the sense like, I don't know, like,
I had a computer with the internet connection at home.
Not bad.
That's about it. I think spent a big chunk of the first few years of having that computer just playing games, nothing else.
Did you think of getting into like professional gaming or something like that?
No.
Nothing like that.
I don't think I was very good at gaming.
Just like for fun.
Just for fun. That's all.
Okay.
But once I started coding, I started enjoying. I think I also sort of intuitively understood it. So spent all of my college time doing that. I think throughout college, I think second year of college onwards, I just started freelancing. By the time I hit final year, I probably built like 10, 12 software projects for some clients somewhere. So that's where it sort of started, and I liked that part. So I didn't want to do it at a big company. That's when, like, when I was doing these freelancing gigs in college, that's when I found out there's this thing called a startup, which is just small companies where you get to do more things yourself than being at a large company. That was my understanding of a startup.
You did your engineering in University of Mumbai, no?
Yes.
Like,
I graduated 2012. So those were the early days of Bombay startup ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So again, so, you know, timing kind of aligned well.
But your decision to kind of choose engineering was mostly because of love for programming, is it? Like, is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, also, I'm just a Mallu boy from a middle class family.
Oh, okay.
So engineering is the default.
Okay.
What else are you going to do? Right? It's just, it was more like, if you want to do something, okay, finish engineering and then figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So engineering was sort of the default choice. And it just so coincidentally happened that I liked it and I was good at it. Yeah.
The software engineering part. Did you have this thought that you wanted to like start a business or something like that?
Not really. I mean, you know, working at a startup versus working at a big company, that itself was like a mind-blowing deviation from the normal path of a you know.
Back then, you're 2012, you're saying, no?
Yeah.
Even though I'm saying back then as if it's the 50s, but even nowadays, even movies you get to see, like flashbacks are no longer like in the 90s.
Yeah,
they're like early 2011, that's the flashback.
Exactly. So that's my flashback, right? So that itself was like a big move to make. Starting your own business was just like that was never part of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
At that point I did that briefly, did sort of start a startup in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Like three of us or four of us or so, I don't even remember, and we would go around talking to customers or whatever, and got acqui-hired at that point. So
we got
acqui-hired, not acquired. So
okay.
They rolled out an offer for everyone to individually join their company.
Uh-huh.
Everyone else joined. I was like,
oh, okay.
It just, the whole point was to not join a big company. So why would I do this? So I was just back again, just hanging around startups, figuring out what to do.
I think, can you speak to that? I mean, during that time, in the sense, today, if somebody wants to like start a business, I mean, there are so many, not only Western, entrepreneurs who have like done it before, and you know, who can be like sort of role model, but even I think in 2022, I think there are Indians as well. During that time, was there any role model or some success story that you could make? Maybe Flipkart, but I don't know how popular or whether how mainstream.
Yeah, 2012, it was still early days for Flipkart. I think this was like still cash on delivery days.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have online transactions. And I think I was also very young to know a lot. I don't remember any big role models in the ecosystem or anything, because not that they didn't exist, but maybe my purview was very limited.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a few friends in the tech ecosystem, and you know, I just like the idea of being able to write code, build things.
And I think tech was also not as huge as it is today.
After
2016, after the Jio thing.
I think 2016 2016 is when we got started as a VC, and we saw that 2016 was the funding window. So 2015 is when SoftBank, Tiger, they all sort of stopped investing in India towards the end of 2015.
Really? Okay.
So 2016, no one was investing. That's when we
kind
of.
But why is that? Why the
They made a few investments. They were probably not happy or whatever. So they just took a temporary pause at that point.
Mm-hmm.
2016 was sort of a dull year. 2017 with Jio and all of that is when things really took off. Jio, UPI, all of that, right? That's where the takeoff really happened.
A lot of good things came together.
But
I think before we speak about these great things, I want to go back to you were one of the founding members of Code for India as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes.
What was your thinking like? I mean, what plans did you kind of have for that? And
didn't. I was just too young and I wanted to do anything related to coding.
Okay.
It was that simple. It wasn't a grand plan or anything of that sort. So I just genuinely enjoyed writing code, and I just kept doing that. Wherever there was an opportunity, I worked with a couple of startups around that point where I would help them on the code stuff, and it wasn't for money. They were like, we can't afford to pay you money. I'm like, that's okay, just like let me work at a startup. It was just young and curious and just exploring, that's all.
I think those are the things you can only do
I'm kind of glad that at that point I did it.
Mm-hmm. How long were you kind of involved with that though?
About a year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took up a job as first employee at a tech company in the Bay Area and spent about 3.5-4 years there.
The software architect role, is it? You did that in the US?
That was a Bay Area company.
Okay.
I didn't want to take the H-1B visa.
Why?
So you get stuck to a job, right? Again, the whole premise at that point for me was have the ability to explore.
Okay.
What's out there.
You didn't want to like go to the US then?
I went the first time. So I took a B1B2, which is a tourist visa. I went there for the first time, stayed there for a few months, came back. And you know, I was like, okay, fine. I mean, it's a good place, but I didn't care beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, again, as an engineer, you're in front of a laptop writing code for the most part, and all the activity happens inside your head. So at that point, geographically, where are you located just didn't make sense to me. Like, I didn't care enough. And it was mostly a trade-off of, like, you know, you take an H-1B, you're stuck with an employer. And that early on, I didn't want to do that. So I used to do back and forth between Bombay and Bay Area at that point, and did that for 3-4 years.
Oh, okay, okay. In my mind, you've always been in Bangalore, so
No. I came to Bangalore for the first time in 2016.
2016, is it?
Yeah.
So, the transition from, like, your software majority role or software heavy role, like, what kind of gravitated you towards venture? Is it the money, or is it, like, but to be fair, like, I mean, software engineers in general also make a lot of money.
Yeah.
I don't know VC level money, but I mean, they do make a lot of money.
Probably more than VC level money also in some cases. So I was at that company. Again, I've always liked early stage startups. I always liked early stage company. I was the first employee at that company. I was there for a long time. That company scaled up. We were maybe 100 people or so. I was sort of a glorified manager at that point. I had a team to run. I think I was 26 maybe. And I just got bored. At 26, who wants to be a manager?
I think a lot of people. Okay.
So I quit.
Okay.
And again, I was unemployed, back to square one. And that's when sort of this opportunity came up, and I was like, okay, I mean, if one, sounds interesting. Second, better than being unemployed.
What do you mean came up? Like, I don't understand.
So, like I said, over there, I was the first employee. The second employee at that company, is my current colleague here, Pranav.
The second employee in that company was Pranav, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So then I didn't know this. He had also quit separately. So we were just chatting, and he's like, okay, what do you think about, you know, VC? I'm like, sounds good.
Really? Okay. All right. Understood. So you take the leap, is it?
You take the leap. I mean, was I qualified to be first employee at a Bay Area tech company at the age of 22? I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Worked out well. At some point, you have to. I mean, it boils down to really what are you betting on, right? And for me, I've been betting on myself. It's been okay so far.
So during the period that you quit, and you know, you were kind of like taking it easy. Did you formulate some other evil plans or other plans that you were thinking of doing before you got the call from Pranav?
Not really. It was also, that's the other thing about engineering. It's very easy to push yourself on the deep end. You don't realize when you sat for like 6 hours and written code nonstop. And I was at a point of burnout.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't really in a hurry to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Partly one of the things I liked about VC as a space, which was that I'm not required to write code.
What do you still do?
Now I do for fun. So that's different. I'm not doing it to, you know,
push a feature or
hit the timelines within a sprint or
mm-hmm.
clear out like 20 Jira tickets or any of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just doing it because I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Understood. So you made the move from Bombay to Bangalore?
Yeah. Again, just like, you know, Bay Area, Bombay didn't matter, Bombay, Bangalore didn't matter. It's okay. I mean, in your early or mid-20s,
mm-hmm.
where you are, it doesn't matter. You don't have a family, you haven't bought a house, there is nothing really. So those things were simple. I think I was more inclined towards exploration. Yeah.
How do you find the city? Like, how did you find the city when you moved in initially, but also over the years? I think you've been here for 6-7 years now, so.
Yeah. When I moved in initially, it was a bit surprising because it was slow compared to Bombay.
Really? It was slow compared to Bombay, is it?
Yeah.
In what way you mean, like?
I mean,
Because I've heard that before. Like, I think another person also said the similar, that Mumbai is much, like, seems faster.
Yeah, like, to give you an example, you know how when it rains here, suddenly you can't find cabs or autos.
Mm-hmm.
in Bombay, you'll just find people just don't like take a break for whatever reason. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but because of that, there's like always energy. Like if it happens even now, if I go to Bombay, so like I'll be on one end of Bombay and my friends, maybe they finish work in the other end at 9 o'clock, and they'll be like, yeah, I can reach where you are at by 11, 11:30, and then we can hang out. And that's just
constantly buzzing.
It's just constantly. And that was like a shock. I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's just different compared to Bangalore. Is a bit more laid back. It's a bit more relaxed.
Really?
Yeah. I definitely. That was another reason.
I haven't lived in Bombay, so I have no point of reference to like. And I come from a small town as well. So for me, it was a step up.
Yeah.
And
for me, this is like a relaxing place to be at. And that's another reason I didn't want to be in the Bay Area. I went to Bay Area first when I was 22, and Bay Area is like more quieter, relaxed, slower than a small town in India. And
Bay Area is more quieter. I thought you'd say like people work all the time and people are building companies all the time.
That's a subset. I mean, if you go to like, if you pick like Mountain View, like 90% of Mountain View is Google employees, and they're just that, they're Google employees. Google has 170,000 people. You expect everyone to be hustling it out 24/7. That's not happening, right? There'll be a few founders.
170,000 people.
170,000
people. 170,000. Oh my god.
Yeah. So you don't expect them to be hustlers, right? There'll be founders who are doing those things, of course, no doubt. And we have that in Bangalore also. So that's fine. But otherwise, it's like a very, very sleepy town.
Besides being slow, did you notice anything? And also, I think you said initially you found it slow. So that means over the years, do you think?
No, I think I would just read to the back of the
page. Yeah, it's gone the other way.
Right. But I think overall, I think if someone asks you how's Bangalore, you cannot give an answer without mentioning the weather. So you know, it's a good it's good weather at all times.
Before we decided to have a chat, I had sat down with Pranav.
Okay.
And that whole, I think we just spoke 5 minutes about like, I don't know, Pranav, and then the next 50 minutes was just about Bangalore and all that.
Nice.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, he's grown up here, so he has a different
thing. Yeah, he had a lot of things to say about the city and, you know.
Yeah. I don't have that context. I've always seen it as a big city. I've heard that it used to be a quiet, small town, which was a lovely place to be in, but I've never seen that, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. On venture, so when you started off as principal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're a partner. Could you just, for starters, just can you give us like small definitions of like difference between like a principal and a partner?
Well, I mean, usually principals don't do. I mean, principals do deals along with a partner. Usually it's the partner who's got the liability or neck on the line in a certain sense.
If the deal goes bad.
Yeah. So principals are also like very, very close to partner. I mean, they're almost like junior partner level. So it's not that they're very disconnected, but it's just those subtle differences. I don't think it's a big gap. In VC funds, you have analyst, associate, principal and partner. So principal is someone who's on track to eventually become partner in a certain sense. Fewer liabilities, maybe lesser responsibilities, that's all. But that's where it is. Usually both principals and partners end up making decisions on deals.
And like, what does it take for a principal to be promoted to partner? And is that the hierarchy? Is that like a strict hierarchy where that's like the next thing that happens, or is there something?
Depends. Not all principals might end up being partners. Because you can only have so many partners at any given time. So if you have like 3 partners and 5 principals, and someday the fund decides we should add 2 more partners, 2 out of the 5 become partners.
Mm-hmm.
So the other 3 may become later or might quit and move on. But usually it's just that what kind of deals you've underwritten and how has that portfolio performed. I think that's the single biggest thing on like,
if the companies that you've invested in do well,
you eventually
understood. What kind of preparation that did you have to do? Like, I mean, since you were changing industries, Did you have to do like a lot of what improvisation did you do? Like,
well, I mean, I think I had a bit more of a luxury from what I'd done before, because while I was in tech, I was also the first employee. So I had seen more things. I'd done some product, some marketing, I'd done sales calls, all of that stuff, because as a first employee, you're sort of all over the place. So it was kind of good because I had seen more parts of a startup life cycle that a average engineer would have, and that helped. But even then, being an operator versus being an investor is just very, very different. When you're an operator, you can always go in and fix problems. Being an investor, you need to know where to draw the line, right? If I invest in your company and if things are not going well, I mean, I can only do so much. I'm an investor,
mm-hmm.
right? I cannot be pushing myself to run the company on your behalf. I cannot be crossing certain lines. So just sort of mentally telling yourself that while you're invested in a business, it's still not your business, and keeping that separation, it's an interesting challenge.
I mean, like, so the companies that you kind of invest, I mean, in general, like, you like to have a hands-off attitude, is it? Like,
not really hands-off, right? But you're not an operator anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? I wouldn't say hands-off. We are still very, very deeply involved. We work with them very closely.
Because I think some founders don't like a lot of a lot of inputs, or you know, they have their own thing.
No, I think the thing is, I don't think any founder has problems with a lot of inputs.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is when the VC expects every bit of input to be enforced, right? I'll give input, whether you take it or not, that's up to you. It's your business, right? And I'll constantly give input. I hope you take it, but that's where I said, right, I'm not the operator, I'm not running the business, you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to be able to be in that position where I say, I could give 10 inputs, maybe 2 of them are taken this time, maybe 8 of them are, that's okay, but that's not my problem, I did my job.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to give input, not to make sure the company is run a certain.
So when you made those, when you made those initial first few investments, how are you thinking about those? Like, what kind of, right now you have a lot of knowledge, with the experience that you have gained, but if we can use this knowledge to go back and maybe initially how you were thinking, and of those first few investments, what comments would you make about those? Like, how you kind of made those? And
So it's a mix of things, right? Obviously, by default, everyone understands certain businesses better than certain other businesses. So knowing where your strength is matters a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? Some people may have a more intuitive sense on B2B software, right? And not as much on what a semiconductor chip business should look like. Yeah, that's perfectly fine. Don't do semiconductor chip, do more B2B software. Sometimes it's also about knowing what your strength is, right? Maybe for a B2B software business, I know that I can help them plan their entire GTM, but maybe I cannot help them on tech. If that's the case, then by default, I will invest more in tech-driven SaaS founders because I can't help them on tech. So I hope they're good at tech, and GTM I can help them on, right? Or it could be the other way around, then the kind of founders you invest in changes. So knowing what works well for you, where your strengths are, is independent of your investing wisdom in a certain sense, right? You just know what you're good at, what you're bad at, what you understand, what you don't understand. So I think the starting point was that,
mm-hmm.
more than anything. Now, of course, like 314 has a portfolio of about 70 odd companies. I have owned maybe like 30, 35 of those companies.
Mm-hmm.
So now there is enough pool to have that data and that feedback loop going. But in the early days, it's about just knowing what are the one or two things I'm really good at and just investing in that.
So in that sense, I mean, two things. So one, does 314 also only specialize in, like, they only want to do X?
No, as a fund, we are very sector agnostic.
Okay.
As individual investors,
wow.
Also, we are very sector agnostic, but over a period of time, you just learn more about one business than the other. You'll not be learning about every business in a very evenly distributed manner. It just doesn't happen like that, right? I mean, I've had more hits in, say, consumer internet or SaaS. Some of my colleagues have had more hits in fintech. So now if you have, say, two fintech unicorns in your portfolio, by default, you've just seen more of fintech. And making the next fintech bet is easier for you, right? Doesn't mean that you will not do anything that's not fintech, but just basis the distribution in your portfolio, you've learned more about certain things and learned less about certain other things. That's all.
So when it's sector agnostic, like, how do you kind of prepare for, a lot of these companies will present stuff which may be on the bleeding edge or which may be new. How do you kind of, or VCs in general, like, how do they kind of stay, how do they prepare themselves to be like aware of something that's happening or?
So two things, right? One is that sometimes the portfolio itself helps a lot. So for example, if I'm an investor in Flipkart, by virtue of being an early investor in Flipkart, I have by default learned about how the entire logistics business works, because Flipkart has to have logistics. And making my next investment in logistics, even though I don't have a history in logistics, is easier, right? Because no business is sort of vertical self-contained in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
If I make investments in consumer internet, maybe I just end up learning a lot more about marketing automation, because consumer internet firms have to do that at scale. And understanding the nuances, finding a marketing automation SaaS company and investing in it becomes easier. So sometimes just as the portfolio scales, you learn about the periphery of each and every one of your portfolio company. And that is the best kind of learning to have. Sometimes you just come across companies that you had not thought of at all before, in which case you have to do that deep dive work, you have to talk to experts, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, I would still say a lot of it is the former rather than the latter. We see a lot of interesting things happening, we reach out, we end up doing deals, and that's where we find a lot of our portfolio.
How do you like find companies in the sense, like, I mean, do they kind of reach out to you via email, or like, is there a
email, LinkedIn, someone makes an intro, through a referral or whatever. Sometimes we reach out because we've heard about them. So it's just many, many different ways. I think the majority, I would say, is still someone writing to us, because
they are into it.
Yeah, and also, like, if I have to reach out, I can only reach out to so many people in a month. If people are reaching out to me, that's just infinitely scalable, right? The more people have heard of me, the more they'll reach out to me.
So, but I'm guessing that a lot of people reach out to you, and like do you have like a goal that over the, like, in a week you have to at least go through X number of companies and.
So we look at and we respond to every company that comes in our radar,
mm-hmm.
whether it is through an intro, whether it is someone writing to us or whatever, right? And that ranges anywhere from 600 to 700 companies a month. We don't set a goal or anything. When we started, it was maybe 20 companies a month. Now it is at 600-700 a month, and maybe it goes up, maybe it doesn't. We'll see. But number of companies is not really a goal. We think of it as a byproduct of how good we are at finding companies. But yeah, that's where it is, and we look at everything, we personally respond to every one of them. We think part of our job is sort of customer service towards the founders,
mm-hmm.
so ignoring them is never a...
And mostly early stage, no? Or is it only
early stage? Up to Series B.
Okay.
Could be idea stage, two guys in a deck, could be Series B, but in that window.
Mm-hmm. How much time do you personally take for you? How much time for you at this point, like, does it take to like fund a company, like from the moment you've gotten to know someone, like what's the average, like?
It's about 2 to 3 weeks. Now that we've seen enough, also in the first week we have some general sense. Sometimes it may take a little longer if it's a company in an entirely new space, then you do more work. But usually, yeah, I'd say 2 to 4 weeks.
And are there some things, is there a checklist that, I mean, what are the things that you...
No, you can't do it that way. See, the thing is, you know, and I know like a lot of VC is that pattern matching, but at the same time, we are in the business of finding outliers, right? If you want to find that one outlier company, how can you build a checklist for outliers? It just that it's a very paradoxical statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you cannot say, hey, if you fit within these 10 patterns, then you're definitely an outlier. That's the opposite definition of an outlier.
Yeah.
So you can't have that checklist. To be very honest, it doesn't work like that. A lot of our bets that are successful today are very, like, going back, we debated a lot on that. They were sort of counterintuitive to a certain sense, but someone or the other within the team had enough conviction to keep backing, and that's what's worked out. So, like, if it's a segment that everyone is investing in, then you're not really finding outliers.
When you're talking about, like, you know, there are companies where somebody has had like a lot of conviction. I mean, is it because of the founders, or is it because the person in who's vouching for them feels that, you know, this market is going to be huge?
Could be one of the many things.
Could
be anything. So, for example, so there's a company called Cuckoo FM.
Huh, I think I've heard about it.
It's in the audio tech space, right? Now, we invested in them, I think, early 2018, if I remember correctly. And the thinking was, look, UPI has taken off. Digital penetration has gone through the roof thanks to Jio. If that's the case, more and more people will consume content, right? It was fair. There was enough data to show. So obviously, more and more people will consume Cuckoo FM. And that's understandable. Now, if you look at some other behavior, so for example, we talked about Flipkart, right? Flipkart started off and people just wanted to do cash on delivery, because who the hell is going to transact online? That's risky. Who puts your credit card number on a website? Today, do you think twice?
No,
right?
Literally.
So, and you know, you could talk to people maybe a generation before, our parents, our uncles or whatever. I can assure you that because they are used to spending money online, they also just spend more. The friction to spending has gone down, right? Credit cards do that to people, by the way, even in offline. Instead of paying cash, when you're paying card, it doesn't feel like spending money.
Yeah.
So you spend more, right? So the thinking was, if UPI is taking off, would people eventually have a lower bar of spending money online, right? Because, I mean, look, how many, if I'm doing UPI transactions 10 times a day, like, spending money has sort of become like an afterthought. You just do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the other thinking, which is that, look, if digital penetration goes up, people will consume more content, but eventually people will be open to spending money on content too, right? Now, that's a bit of a leap of faith to take. In 2018, there wasn't enough data to show that. If you wanted to rely on data entirely, then, you know, you wouldn't invest in Cuckoo FM. But today they have close to 2 million paying subscribers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's fairly significant. And this has only happened in the last 20 months, right? So it took a while for monetization to kick in. When it kicked in, it really grew. But that is saying that, look, I think the market will move in a certain direction, and this is the team that will make it happen. And sometimes it is about taking that bet without having a lot of data to show for it. You have certain trends, you have certain, you know, headwinds in the market.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just that. And you have to ride on that conviction, right? But the point is, again, coming back, if historical data needs to be extrapolated to take a bet, then
it's not really
an outlier.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're just like riding on a projection. That's not an outlier. Outlier is when it deviates from the projection.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So sometimes you have to make those bets.
So, like, I feel like, at least in my mind, I feel like Leon Foucault kind of started at this right time. I don't. It's a nice story in obviously in hindsight. It's a good narrative. Where it started in like 2016 you mentioned, and then you know Jio happened, and then I'm just curious like what kind of trends that you kind of were discussing internally, and you know what kind of discussions were you having internally that you know these XYZ markets would be huge, and what kind of markets were you targeting, and how have they kind of panned out? Like maybe some of the markets that you might have been thinking of would be huge internally, but were disasters or didn't really pan out. And what were your like initial those debates and?
So the way we look again, multiple of us have had stints in the US and have come back here, and we have done that because we are over a long term bullish on India and Indian markets, right? So we think all of these markets are set to grow. We think there is enough macro push to say that India will keep growing, and will keep growing at a very good pace, right? So there is that inherent bullishness, inherent optimism that does exist. Now, many other factors, whatever, Jio, UPI, GST, whatever, all of that stuff have accelerated some of those things, which is good. That's not something we could have foreseen, but when it happened, it was great. And over there, few things were obvious, right? I mean, if you're enabling digital transactions so excessively, if you're streamlining banking regulations the way Aadhaar has enabled eKYC, this, that, you know, fintech markets will open up. GST ensures that B2B SME markets do open up. At the same time, amazing companies like Freshworks, Chargebee, this, that, being built out, Mindtickle being built out. The timing was great. India's B2B SaaS market opened up, right? And to the point that I made earlier, which is when you're bullish that Indian consumer will pay for goods online, the consumer internet market opens up. So we've saw that some of these markets had a very clear path to just growing faster relative to everything else, and we just started making bets. Now, it's also not about market. Sometimes the company doesn't find PMF, and because of that, the company may not scale. Doesn't necessarily mean that the market is bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes maybe the bet is just too counterintuitive, and not enough investors buy into that, so they can't raise enough capital. Could happen, doesn't necessarily mean the market is bad, right? So there are many different factors that could go wrong when you're making investments, and that's the learning process. But at just a market level, I think to your point, the timing is just amazing, and there's no reason for things to slow down now either. That's how we look at it, and that's why we just continue to be bullish.
Just on the timing part, I mean, today I think we've seen like a recent downturn. That's been my understanding. How is that like? Do you guys pay attention to these factors, or
I mean, you have to pay attention. There's no way you can not pay attention. But the question is, you know, how seriously do you take it?
Mm-hmm.
How much of it is very systemic? How much of it is just sort of short-term effects of what's happening globally? I think those things also have to be taken into proper consideration, right? Like, it's not like India saw a slowdown because global investors stopped investing, not because something fundamentally went wrong with India. So in that sense, it's not a macro slowdown. It's just that investors said, okay, let us just halt investing for a while. So it's a manufactured slowdown, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that will only last for so long before investors come back. So that's perfectly fine. It doesn't matter. Right, that's more of investor sentiment than a fundamental market problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, then you continue investing because sentiments change. If underlying economy is rotten, then you don't invest because you know you're heading for a bad crash. But we don't think that's the problem with India. At least there's not a lot of data to show that. You know, inflation is in check, interest rates are in check, all of that. Stock markets are doing fairly well. Companies are still posing revenue. There's not much of a concern around consumption or anything. So there's no reason to worry.
Mm-hmm.
If something changes tomorrow, of course, we'll worry. But Right now, nothing. And, you know, we don't think investors not investing for 6 months will wipe out the ecosystem either. So we've been investing. This year, we've done 9 to 10 deals already. So we don't slow down. In fact, 2016, when we started, no one was investing and we invested a lot and that worked out well. Every new fund that we launched has been around a time frame when no one has been investing. So we like it when no one else invests. We get
more,
to play the game.
More
solo.
Okay.
Exactly.
Understood.
More deal, less competition is good.
How is the competition though? Like, I mean, like I think initially we started off saying that, you know, 2004, there were not, I mean, these companies were just setting up shop here.
Yeah.
Today, like, how are you
looking
at
it? Oh, it's tough. It's very tough. Uh-huh. It's, I mean, when people ask me, how should I get into VC now, I tell them don't. It's
because of the competition or because
it's really difficult to get started as a VC. I mean,
but,
like, you could get
yeah.
a job at a VC, but like getting in, getting deals done, it's
uh-huh.
not easy. It's like, it's a very, very efficient market. It's a very efficient system. Like any company you're looking at, 10 others are looking at. It's
so does that mean that's good for the founder, is it?
Good for the founder, yeah. So far so good. Like, I mean, I know global investors who are today telling that we prefer investing in the Bay Area and not in India because valuations are too high in India compared to Bay Area.
Really?
So, yeah. So, you know, it's a good time to be a founder. Even now, deals are competitive. I think it's a bit more concentrated, more competition going behind fewer founders. Which is okay, but like the best founders get the best deals.
Mm-hmm. Just I wanted to touch on it. I mean, what are your thoughts on, like, till now I feel my opinion is US has been producing these you know, large companies and like global players, and like most of the hype, like cutting edge tech, has been coming from the US. At least that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, do you, because of like innovation in multiple geographies and countries, do you think US in particular is going to face like a slowdown, or face like they will not be at the peak?
I mean, look, first of all, the head start they have is massive, right? There is these ecosystems evolve in stages, right? And if you look at Silicon Valley, they've built a lot of great companies, great global companies over multiple decades. So there are generations and generations of entrepreneurs who know how to build global companies, and that insight keeps getting passed down to the next generation, right? It's that compounds, that insight helps. So there is some moat in that, right? So if you look at India, for example, every few years we are building bigger and bigger companies, right? There was a time when unicorns were rare. Now there are so many unicorns, mm-hmm. and everyone's aiming for a $10 billion outcome. In hopefully in a decade or so, people would be aiming for $50 billion outcome. That takes a while. We don't have a lot of precedence of Indian companies going global. When the first few set of Indian companies go global, they have the learnings, and then people from there leave and they'll start companies which will go global faster, and people from there will leave and will start companies which will go global even faster. So that sort of knowledge pass through has to happen, that learning has to happen.
But you're saying this trend is in place where, you know, Indian companies will build like global brands?
Of course. I mean, look, Ola has done that, Zomato has done that, quite a few of these companies have already done that. Freshworks and the B2B SaaS ecosystem has already done that quite a few times, mm-hmm. right? So the first wave has already started to happen. The guys who say led international expansion at Zomato, if they ever join a startup or start a startup, they know what can go wrong when you go international. They might do it better the second time around, right? That's valuable. And that matters. So, but you have to go through that cycle. It doesn't happen overnight. More and more people that go through add more value to the ecosystem. So Bay Area has a big head start. We're catching on.
A few more generations. You mentioned on the valuations. Like, do you think those valuations like are like my knowledge in this is a bit low. So. Do you think those valuations are like sustainable? Because I some of those companies which I think had like huge valuations in like during COVID times, they had seen like massive layoffs later on. And so in general, like, what are your thoughts on?
Not all of them will sustain the valuations. Some of them will break out. Some of them will exceed their current valuations. It will always be a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Okay. But
I mean, there are companies in public, there are publicly listed companies that go bankrupt. So why can't a unicorn go bankrupt?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, what is that? Companies go south all the time. Companies collapse in revenues all the time. Right? Startups will also go through the same. I don't see why that's a big deal.
Is there something that you've seen over the year? Is there something that you've seen or noticed like a huge red flag where you think after that companies, like there's a huge...
See, there are many different things, right? Like sometimes markets shift, sometimes a new competitor comes in. It's really hard to say that there are one or two...
But something in maybe... market changes are not in the person's control, right? Like, is there something that you've seen where it is in our control or in the firm's control, and then there's...
I think there's a lot of, I mean, if you look at recent memory, there's been a lot of compliance, governance, those kind of issues that have popped up, where for whatever reasons, founders may not have taken it seriously, may have willingly or unwillingly sort of flouted some of these things. Those are definitely, you know, red flags that you want to look out for at all times. I mean, you're running a large company with multiple shareholders. Being compliant to everything is just very, very critical. So that does come to mind from more recent memory, so to speak. But yeah, other than that, I mean, most of these are like sort of unique individual events. I mean, barring for like fraud, corruption and stuff like that, it's really hard to prepare. You just try to be as vigilant as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. What sectors are you like most into about, or
India's consumer internet landscape seems to be very, very interesting today.
Mm-hmm.
And that means everything from social media, content startups, consumer health, consumer education, consumer gaming, basically the whole India specific apps for the consumer. I think there is a lot more to be done there. We're barely scratching the surface, and the fact that digital penetration is increasing, digital transactions penetration is increasing, only opens up more and more wallet share from long tail India for all of these services. So that's definitely a massive play that we are very excited about. I think India's B2B software ecosystem is also maturing at an incredibly rapid pace. There are amazing founders building amazing SaaS companies out there. And I think those are just like the first set of candidates for really high quality software export from India to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we love that. Would love to just keep doing more and more of those deals.
Understood. What do you do for, like, I mean, when you're not like thinking about investing,
mm-hmm.
during weekends and all, like, what do you do to unwind then?
I write code.
You write code, huh?
It helps.
I mean, is it like therapy? Is it like, I mean, is it like very therapeutic?
In a way,
like,
in a way.
Like, run and, you know, they feel that.
I run too. I like fitness to a certain extent.
Mm.
But I think different things serve different purpose. Coding is still essentially building something. And there's always fun in building something.
So I mean, when you code nowadays, like hackathon challenges, is it?
No, no.
What
I build apps. I put it out there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They get users. They get like the more. I love experimenting with monetization, just making money, just for the heck of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of stuff. Yeah, I got one app live now, which just makes like $5,000-$6,000 a month.
Really?
Yeah. But it's fun to do that, right? I mean. Am I trying to build a unicorn out here? No, I have a job to worry about. But these kind of things, when you just do that, it's fun.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you work out, like, is running the only thing, or like?
Running, strength training, badminton.
Okay, and every day, is it, or?
Gym almost like 4 or 5 times a week. Everything else, whenever I can.
Okay. All right, Anurag, thank you for taking the time. It was nice having you. Thank you.
Cool, awesome.